Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Hey, Rad Gontos.
Hey, Paul. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good. I always look forward to this discussion. You really dig up stuff that we all should be talking about as baby boomers, and we don't.
Okay. Before we start, though, we do have an
announcement. Okay.
An announcement. Yes, I do.
Okay.
Not everybody can see this, but Paul is actually wearing corporate colors today.
I am. I'm dressed in orange.
He is dressed in orange. So it's either Syracuse or it's the radio show. I'm not sure which one.
Well, Orange County Talk Radio, OC Talk Radio. I figure everything's got to be orange. Everything's orange in the studio
the
here. Orange.
Yeah, okay, sorry. That's the connection.
And that's hard for me to say because I'm Irish. And if you're Irish Catholic, orange is the evil color. It's the Protestant color. So
you wear it with pride.
I wear it in spite of that.
Anyway, so if anybody would like a orange sweater.
Got them.
Paul's got them.
Lots of them.
All right. Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. I'm getting back serious now, Paul. Today, you know, I've said this when we first started the show, is that the whole point for me to do this show was to talk about stuff that we encounter as we journey through life, as we get to a certain point in life when we feel like we don't have all the time in the world, and actually time is finite, and quality of time that we spend, whether it's educating ourselves or spend with loved ones and family and significant others and, you know, happy moments. Those are very, really, very precious.
No time to waste.
And yet here I am wasting the time.
No, I don't think so.
But so one of the things that we also pride ourselves on the show is that we really like to take a proactive approach to aging and getting older and journeying through life than a reactive one.
Isn't that what the baby boomers have tried to do at every stage? We've tried to take control of our lives, whether it's 20s or 40s, when we were hippies or yuppies, we were still trying to redefine the way that age is lived.
Right. And I think, again, in keeping with the fact that this is primarily boomer driven, but you know, we did coin a term. I want to claim the term. Wikipedia, if you're listening, this is our term.
Yes.
You know, there are boomers, and there's wannabe boomers.
Exactly. You're all wannabe boomers.
We're wannabe really. Boomers. But you know what? That just sounds good, right? Even though it really shouldn't sound good, but it sounds good. So, some of the things that we talk about here, and we started off our first show was with, you know, elder abuse and stopping elder abuse. Some of this stuff is not going to be lighthearted.
No.
Some of it is going to be heavy. And I think that's kind of what we have, you know, today is we have a heavy topic to discuss. Oh, I can hear the footsteps. They're all running off, you know,
yes,
turning off. They're switching stations.
I wanted to just be
right.
Funny and fun.
Right.
And, you know, that's, I say the biggest criticism of my generation, I'm going to be 60 in January, I keep saying, is that we won't grow up. So in some ways, we're the Peter Pan generation. That's good. We dress young. We act young. We think young. But at the same time, we don't want to face anything. My wife's going to be 65 this year. Mm-hmm. If she was listening right now, she'd whack me at the back of the head here. There's nothing good about 65 in her mind. Everything is
speaking of being whacked by your wife, did she whack you for that food and diet?
I got locked out for a night on that one.
Yeah, Paul has an interesting relationship.
I love to spill all her thoughts here.
Do you remember the Columbo series where, you know, the guy always referred to his wife, but we never saw who his wife was?
Yes, exactly.
I think we're starting something similar. Yeah,
but I don't think we face these things, and I know in my own life I haven't faced these things. I don't think we've saved enough money. I don't think we're ready for aging parents to take care of them. I don't think we're ready for boomerang kids. We're not ready for half of these discussions that you're bringing out here, and we should be.
Right, and I think if we talk about this stuff and we talk about it early enough, then we're not under the gun. We're not faced by the time, you know, pressure of having to act upon it.
Yes.
It actually gives us a chance to take it, put it on the shelf, sort of be aware of it, think about it, and absorb it. And every step of life, okay, whether it's birth, you know, we celebrate birth. We celebrate.
And look how much people prepare for birth. Oh, my goodness, especially baby boomers. I mean, we read every book. We go to every class.
Right.
We're ready for it.
And I can't speak, right?
Yeah.
You and I are not the the people delivering on that promise. But but the point is you can read all you want. At the end of the day, it also you need time to digest the stuff and come to terms with it.
And you got to be willing to face. I'll tell you a funny story about Bertha. My daughter just gave birth to our first grandchild. I have one daughter.
Congratulations.
And she nor I, neither of us thought, well, Dad should be, that I should be in the room here. This is too weird or something to see. And so I thought, okay. And so, but I was in the room. We raced her there because she started, it started happening rather quickly. And I got into the room, and all of a sudden, I couldn't get out. The staff's coming in. They're pushing me aside, and they're pushing me into the corner. And like it or not, I'm there. I didn't really want to see my little girl give birth here. And yet, it was the most amazing, miraculous thing. And I'm so glad I didn't miss this thing. And that happened almost a year to the day that I was in the room when my dad died. Another thing I never wanted to see, I did not want to be there and see Daddy die. And yet it was very powerful. I won't say it was enjoyable, but it was powerful. It's something I would not have wanted to miss.
So let me ask you something before we transition to this and introduce our guest. When you were going through that with your father, and you were there, okay, obviously, the emotions and everything I can only imagine. I mean, my parents are both still alive. I definitely...
You're not ready for it.
As much as we embrace all this, you're never
ready. Daddy's going. And suddenly, all these thoughts go through your head. I'll tell you, one of the weirdest that comes to me is I thought, and this is horrible, he's dying, and I'm thinking about me. I'm next. There's nobody ahead of me in line. We're all standing in the line ready to jump off a cliff here, and all of a sudden I get up and I'm the next guy to jump off the cliff here. I'm the oldest generation suddenly.
Which is probably also part of why we have a hard time talking about it, right? Because it makes us feel so less immortal, especially for a baby boomer. You're going to live forever. You're going to do everything.
Yes.
You're going to be able to jump off the cliffs of Acapulco when you're 70, and then, your body's supposed to be able to still deal with it.
Had the same feeling with my best friend I grew up with a guy, and he lives out here in Southern California. We've been friends since we were in junior high. He had a heart attack and died on the table, but fortunately came back. But when I got down there, they said, oh, he's gone, he's going. And I thought, my first thought was, of me, what a horrible baby boomer, self-centered kind of reaction. Oh, my God, not only am I going to miss him, but that makes... If it can happen to him, it can happen to me. Okay. It can't happen to me.
Well, no. And that's the other thing, too. We don't really talk about a lot. We just started this show, right? But, I mean, we don't talk about the fact that these things that we're... Like this topic of death, for example, and end of life is something that could happen at any age. It's not age-specific. It could happen from an accident.
There's no guarantee.
None of us are getting out of here... Alive.
My wife always says, because she's a vegetarian, she's very health conscious, she runs and exercises, very, very good shape. And did you hear that, dear? You're in very good shape. She looks great for her. For any age. I won't say for her age. See, I'm going to get slapped if I say that for her age.
I'm so biting my lip to call you something right now.
But we've talked about this. If for some reason she got hit by a bus tomorrow, God forbid, and got up at the pearly gates, God would have some splaining to do.
Yeah.
Why did I work so hard at all this if you were just going to take me at 65 here? Her assumption is that she's going to make it at least till 90 and probably 100.
Well, there's how many industries? I mean, every dang thing out there sells you immortality in one form or the other, right? Beauty, products, skincare, cars. Buy the new Mercedes. You'll feel like 30 years younger.
Yeah, kind of thing.
I mean, it's all driven by that, right?
Right.
Because it's the ultimate thing nobody's going to ever accomplish. Live forever.
Yeah, the Peter Pan generation.
And so we spend all kinds of stuff. We were talking. Let me introduce my guest.
Please.
Okay? Thank you. Because, we've just monopolized this.
We don't need guests. We'll just keep
it. Yeah. What's your wife's name?
Jan.
Jan, Paul is a bad influence on me. I'm picking up bad habits.
She'd agree to that.
So my guests today are from a company you guys have seen their cars. You've seen advertising. It's the largest end-of-life healthcare provider, I believe, in the country, isn't it? Sherry Montgomery and Dr. Thomas Bowie are in the office with us, or in the studio, I should say, with us, and they're from Vitas, V-I-T-A-S. Sherry is their director of market development, and Dr. Bowie is, I believe, an in-home care physician.
Yes.
So welcome to both of you. for being here.
Thank you.
And
thank you for having us.
I apologize for the peanut gallery kind of dance that Paul and I did.
Are we just crazy, or is this the conversation you're hearing everywhere? Don't want to think about it. Don't want to talk about it. Ain't going to look at it. And then, oh, my gosh, who knew? I can't get through it. It's so horrendous.
And that's the whole thing. And one of the things we were talking about before the show as we were walking up here is it's fascinating to me that I will turn on the radio. It actually happened as I was driving up here, right? And there's, you know, Forest Lawn Cemetery selling me plots, right? And all this stuff. And, you know, it's a real estate transaction. Sherry said it's a real estate transaction, so of course we're going to talk about it, right? It's land. Let's buy the land.
Yeah. But it's only going to grow up in value.
It's just fascinating that we have this discussion or where this acceptability in society that we can talk about the plot.
But not the act.
But not the actual getting to the plot. Part.
I'll take you aside for 1 second, then I'll shut up and let them talk to us here. But this was another interesting observation that struck me when I went through both my mother's death and my father's death. And that is that we, as baby boomers, don't want to even celebrate. There's no funeral. There's no nothing. They want to just, we're going to take them out. We're going to immediately cremate them. Somebody has to see them dead. We're going to immediately put them out in some little five-minute ceremony. We're going to put the urn in the wall, and that's it. And that's the way it's been for all of my friends when I went to their parents' death.
Interesting.
And so I did. We're good Irish Catholics. I knew my parents both wanted the whole deal, you know, the rosary before and the funeral. And I was horrified at this. And having gone through it, I thought it was really very powerful. It helps you deal with it. It helps you face it to see them dead. It helps to see them go through this. It helps to celebrate their life. Their whole life comes down to 5 minutes, and we stick it in the wall, and then we run over and have a party here.
And then go eat somewhere at a restaurant.
Yeah. We try. And so I asked the people that my parents were both interned at Forest Lawn, and I said, is this just me? And they said, oh, no, funerals are on the decline. Nobody wants a funeral. Nobody wants to do all this stuff here. We don't want to. My friends, wouldn't bring their kids. We don't want anybody to see a dead body. Mm-hmm. You know, this whole notion that we just want it to be a grandma and grandpa die, somebody dies, they're just gone. And the next day, there's a little five-minute ceremony, and then poof, we're back. We're looking at our watch. We're back at work. You know, it's very quick, not like it used to be.
Yeah, it's...
I don't want to go back to the ages where you have to wear black for a year or something and put a wreath out. But.
No, but there are people, actually, that still do that. And I think it's important at that point in life, just like every other point in life, every other milestone, that people are going to deal with grief, with happiness, with celebration differently.
But deal with it. Don't just shove it under the carpet and go away.
True. Yeah. And we were talking as well about, you know, that the delivery of care, not end of life being one form of care, but delivery of care also has to take into consideration diversity. It has to take into consideration like religious diversity.
Oh, sure.
Dietary diversity. You know, things that are very, those are times when people are in the most vulnerable.
And most primal. And you're going to go back to your most, this instinct that you have.
Basic instincts that you're acting upon. So having somebody being sensitive to those nuances is critical in basically presenting that recipient or that patient or that with the best possible customized care.
So what do you guys do?
So Sherry, I'm going to have you. We do this also, and I pre-warned you. We ask people to tell us how they got to where they are doing what they're doing.
Right.
Yeah. What's your journey?
So, in the 60s, my father was diagnosed with cancer, and that was actually pre-hospice, so the really only option to him was he went to a hospital, and he never came home. He was there for 6 months and passed away in the hospital. We maybe visited him in short bursts, but were really protected from the whole thing because really it's something that children weren't invited to share.
Yeah.
So even after he passed away, we really didn't hear much about him, that, you know, this would be caused my mom pain to talk about him. So it was one of those topics that wasn't brought up. And if anyone said the word cancer, they would say it in a whisper. They wouldn't say cancer. Yeah. They would whisper it. So then I was working at a hospital, Downey Freeman Hospital, and a coworker was diagnosed with breast cancer. And towards the end of her journey, she asked if I would spend every Tuesday night with her, so that she wouldn't be alone, so that if there was any emergencies or she needed anything, I would be there to help her. And I have to say, it was the most amazing journey ever. We had every conversation that two people could have. There was nothing left unsaid. She was so generous in her sharing her thoughts and journey with me. And she had hospice. And hospice really gave us the tools that if something happened, she would be kept comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But in sharing this journey with her, I was so prepared when she finally passed away. Unlike a lot of our other coworkers, I knew that she was accepting of this, that she had asked all of the important questions, and that she was fine. And so, in turn, I was fine.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw the two, you know, contrasting experiences.
Sure.
And that's what led me to hospice.
Interesting.
And is that what you guys do? You're a hospice? I don't know what your company provides. You have to talk into the mic there, not to me.
Well, let me say this. A lot of people,
yes,
me included, okay, maybe it had to do with me being in Switzerland for college, but, you know, we hear the word hospice,
mm-hmm,
and I think a bunch of people probably think hospice is like hostel. It's a building where people with backpacks traveling through Europe stay.
Kind of, it feels like that.
Right?
Yeah.
And it isn't.
Only you're packing your bags to the next journey.
But yeah. I'm going to turn it, defer to Sherry again to share with me what she shared with me a few minutes ago about hospice.
Right. The word actually derived from hospice in Europe was really a place where weary travelers could go to rest.
Hmm.
And I think that really does sum up what we provide.
I'm going to just, you know, for a moment here, you know, make my father proud because he's not listening, but I'll make sure he hears the podcast. It actually goes all the way back to the Templars. It also goes all the way back to the Crusaders and the Hospitallers. And the fact that it was for the pilgrims. There were stops and places where they would basically, the weary traveler, like you said, Sherry.
I've heard that too,
rest. So yeah, it is a place for the weary traveler who rests from his journey or her journey.
And when did this movement take place and when did it arrive here? Because it seems like a rather new phenomenon.
Right, that's a very good question. Our company actually was founded in 1978 and I had the great pleasure of meeting the founders. They were a nurse and a minister who had really been doing a volunteer, just kind of patching together some volunteer support to help people who needed support at end of life. And there really wasn't anything more formalized at that point. So they got together and they really started this movement, you know, in the country in the 70s. They kept lobbying Congress to say this is important to really honor people's end-of-life journey. They should have options. They should have support. And actually, when Ronald Reagan was in office, they finally signed it into effect that this would be a Medicare-covered benefit.
Hmm. Wow. The oldest president ever decided to do something for older people here.
Right.
Yeah, it's funny how the motivation works, right?
Yeah, right. Hospice is what? For those of I have seen and experienced it because, as I said offline, my mother was involved in it many years before her own death, and so I became aware of it. But prior to that, I knew nothing about it. I don't think most people do. So what is hospice? How is it different than a hospital?
Dr. Bowie?
Hospice really is more than just the death experience itself. It involves preparing for death, and it involves a team of people with clinical expertise. You know, people from our company have expert training and specialty training to take care of symptoms, making sure patients and their families are comfortable as their death approaches. Within the team, we have physicians, nurses, social workers, chaplains, and volunteers who really rally around the patient, controlling medical conditions and supporting the family.
And these are outside of hospitals, right? These are people who are judged to be terminal and they're taken somewhere else. Feels more like a home, almost. Can be a home.
Yes. It's, we typically think about it as wherever the patient calls home. So that can be, you know, in his or her home.
Right.
It can be in an apartment setting. It can be in a skilled nursing facility. You know, the work we do, in fact, some of our volunteer work, we've taken care of, you know, homeless patients in the park bench.
Wow.
So wherever they call home.
Wow. And what when is it appropriate? Like who decides and when is it appropriate when somebody is actually ready for hospice?
The hospice benefit really is a Medicare benefit when a patient is determined to be from a best medical estimate to have a life expectancy of 6 months or less. And again, I don't pretend to be God, but based on 9 years of doing this in my specialty training in palliative medicine and hospice care, that a patient's overall global health and specific hospice diagnosis, it would be reasonable to say that he or she may no longer be with us in 6 months. Many times, our patients live beyond 6 months because of the extra care that we're able to provide.
Right.
I'll use the example of my mom. You know, when my mom was on hospice, I mean, there's four doctors in the family, and we were scratching our heads. We thought that, you know, this is really the end for her. And because of the extra support that the hospice team, the clinical staff, the social support, and everything that rallied around her, she got better, and she proved us all wrong. And so she was recertified again, and, you know, actually 4 years later, she's still with us. And so to answer your question, it's really because a doctor and a clinical team assess the patient regularly and say that this patient has a very chronic and advanced illness.
One of the things that struck me when both my parents died was how quickly the staff knew when the end was to. Not when my daddy died suddenly of a heart attack, but my mother, as she was dying, they called us in and said she's, you know, got like 20 minutes. We're like, 20 minutes? How can you say this? Just from experience of doing this. And when my mother worked in hospice many years before, she worked in a facility back in Michigan, an actual a place. I don't know if it was associated with your company or some company, but whatever it was, she went down. She was a volunteer there. And they had little red lights outside the rooms. And I went in there once, and some of the red lights were on. I said, why are those there? And she said, those are for people who are actively dying. And it's like, how do you know they're actively dying? Well, based on what we've seen, this is probably the end here. And so that was just a little subtle thing to be careful as you walk by that room, or to come in and make sure you did come into that room. Somebody is probably actively dying. It was everything that sounded horrible to me then, but I think it's probably one of the most beautiful and wonderful way, because everybody's frightened too when you're dying. They're dying. They don't want to be alone.
Right.
Can you imagine? I don't want to die alone. I don't want to just die in the middle of the night.
And how do you know how to behave in those situations?
Yes, right.
Right. So needing.
So it was comfort. It was support. It was dealing with the grief. It was dealing with your every needs, and it was taking a gentle approach to this, not just sticking you in a bed somewhere and once a day coming and checking and seeing if you're still alive or not.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as society has changed from where people, you know, I mean, we would say, you know, farm to industrial, whatever. But as society has changed, we have stepped further and further away from certain realities of life.
Oh, yes, right.
And we've been kind of basically shielded or
I don't see animals born anymore. Yeah. I don't slaughter them.
You know, don't old chickens come in styrofoam packages and plastic wrappers, you know?
Right.
I think this is where this is really an important conversation, because everybody in this room, everybody that I know, everybody that you know, is going to be faced with this. For somebody that they care about, a loved one, or themselves, and in some cases both.
Right.
You know, it could be sudden. It could be due to a car accident that all of a sudden you get this call in the middle of the afternoon while you're busy
slow,
with your life, or it could drag out. And so having the awareness of it, knowing that by exposing yourself to the discomfort of it earlier on empowers you to actually maybe deal with it better.
And to know that you don't have to go through it alone.
And a family member doesn't have to go through it alone. And so you're not only empowering yourself, but you're also empowering you're increasing your ability to be there for somebody else. You know, and unless you're pursuing it academically as a career path or an academic pursuit, or you're basically working in that environment, most of us are just too busy with our lives, getting in the cars, driving down the freeways all over the place, to stop and think about this.
And we don't want to.
We don't want to.
So tell us some story. Tell us about your company. How many places you got? Or, you know, the work you do? We're locally. Give us the whole overview.
Right. Dr. Bowie and I are from our local branch in Orange County. But VITAS covers 49 different offices. We take care of 15,000 patients on any given day across the country. We have about 11,700 employees that dedicate their time and energy to caring for people at this stage of their life.
Oh.
So we are a large company, but locally we run it like a very small company. You know, we have small individualized teams that are dedicated to, you know, individual patients. But we have this amazing infrastructure that allows us to provide all the medications that they need, all the equipment they need, like electric beds and wheelchairs and things like that, all the supplies. You know, we're able to really individualize care. Everything that we do is based on what is important to the patient and family. Mm-hmm. We ask those questions, you know, what are your goals? What's important to you? How can we help you through this? It's not about saying this is what we provide for everyone. It's about how would you like this to look? How can we give you the tools? How can we empower you?
Well, and we touched on it a little bit earlier, but, you know, I'm sure a lot of the listeners, again, you know, they think of hospice as only for someone who's older.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, or just somebody maybe with cancer.
Right.
Okay? We're not whispering the word anymore, but it's right. Still something we're very uncomfortable talking about, right? But that's not the case, right?
Correct.
So, can you share with us a little bit about the percentage of the, let's say, 15,000 people that you're basically caring for in any day? What's the gamut? What's the range of situations?
Do you want to talk about that?
We take care of patients, you know, pediatric patients, and some of our patients are more than 100 years old.
Wow. Hmm.
And so the predominance of our patients really, really is basically the baby boomer generation, you know. But as we tailor our approach, the family that's grieving the coming loss of their baby is much different from the grief of a person who's been dealing with cancer for years. And so we're able to tailor it specifically towards those needs and, again, support with clinical expertise the symptoms of the disease and also the patient and family.
Who, before we go to the break, Doctor, in a situation like that, either one, you pick, what is the composition of a team of people that basically are providing that care?
Well, the team really primarily is the patient.
Okay.
And so that always remains focal to whatever we do. Around that, it's the family who knows the patient the best. I, as a doctor on the team, often listen to the family members in terms of goals, but also what pain presents like in that patient, as an example. Also on our team, we have a nurse case manager who is dedicated to following that patient usually once a week, if not more often. Some of our patients who are critical and have uncontrolled symptoms, my nurse and I, we visit daily.
Mm.
An important part also is the spiritual support, and our chaplain, our social worker are definitely key for that. And again, our social worker helps coordinate the community to support the family.
Right. So the family is very much part of the caregiving process.
Absolutely.
At that point.
Okay. Focal.
And the way I saw it was it's dying with dignity. You're not just dying in a sterilized environment where nobody cares about you and nobody, you're not connected. You're just one of a number of beds in a room here. It's not something anybody wants to think about, but it's something everybody feels very important at that moment, to die with dignity. It's what Mother Teresa did with the poorest in India. You know, it's finding a way to comfort them and help them through this final step. Okay. That's what I saw.
No, and the reason why I asked is because I think a lot of people is like, oh, you know, who's going to administer any pain mm-hmm. control management? You know, who's going to be there cleaning them? I mean,
so
these are things that you don't talk about, but they're very much part of reality.
And that preparation that we're talking about, it really needs to be very clear so that when the time comes, we know that there is a doctor who's directing the care. We know that also we have home health aides who have special expertise in mm-hmm. taking care of very frail patients mm-hmm. in this transition period. And
when my father was dying, they said, well, at one point he was looking better. They said, well, you can put him in long-term care for $10,000 a month. I said, well, we ain't got that. Or they said, well, you can take him home. What am I going to do with him at home? Well, first of all, I have to quit my job. And secondly, I don't know how to turn him and dress his wounds and all these things here. I'm not prepared to. I didn't want to do it. I don't know how to do it. I can't physically do it or financially do it.
Well, that's where that word frail is not necessarily only the condition, but it's also physical frailty. Mm-hmm. It's emotional frailty.
Oh, all of that. Yeah.
You know, all of it.
All of that. And the frailty globally of the family as you're going through this.
Absolutely.
No one, in my experience and what I'm hearing from you, Paul, is that no one's expecting you to be the doctor or the nurse in that situation. You know, actually, most importantly, we want you to be the son.
Yes, right.
And again, that is so important that we listen to, you know, your loved one, listen to you, and how can we help get your dad what he needs to be comfortable.
Right.
And to really, you know, make this important and a special time. It's never an easy time.
Sure.
But again, it's an important time for families to rally together, to bring closure, and to be very comfortable knowing that dad's not going to suffer.
Yes. Oh, well, and above all else.
Well, and you're providing the family with, like you said, another memorable moment in the life journey of that person versus just something that is just going to tear at the family on every level, potentially. And I think that is invaluable. I think on that note, we'll just go to a break.
Let's do it.
Thank you very much for both being here.
Thank you.
We're having such great conversations offline. To share what you just said here, you were talking about, Dr. Bowie, about people are prepared for expecting a birth, but not expecting to die here.
Right. And so all our lives, I mean, and in this culture, we celebrate, you know, milestones in life. My twins turned one yesterday. And we read books like What to Expect When You're Expecting. And, and even in my fellowship training, we tossed around ideas and things like, isn't this what we do in palliative and hospice care? Aren't our actions writing the book of what to expect when you're expecting your loved one's going to die? And having that conversation really sets the stage that we can really empower patients, you know, families to talk amongst one another.
Yeah.
You know, it's what a gift to be able to tell for a mom to connect with her estranged son.
Yes.
And it's not an academic approach. I mean, it's a personal sharing of your own experience, mm-hmm. in many ways.
Let me share, yeah, a story that's exactly like that. The only story I remember, my mother, for some reason, many years before she died, got interested in hospice. This is back in Michigan. She went and volunteered at this place. And she used to tell these stories. And the one that stuck with me is this one. I don't know if I can get it quite right. But she was assigned to some patient. And this patient has moved into, this was a hospice facility, so they moved in there knowing they had 6 months or less to live. And part of it is, her training was to let people, to. It's okay to let go at some point.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to say, to quit fighting it. That's a horrible thing because we're trained to fight and fight and fight and, mm-hmm. fight and fight. But at some point, she would say, just let go. So this one was really struggling, really in pain, and going to die any minute, and she wouldn't let go. My mother kept saying, let go, just let go, you know. It's okay, we're here and everything. This woman, all through the night, hung on, kept fighting it, rallying, yeah. and everything. They couldn't understand. The woman just kept mumbling. She was almost incoherent. She just kept mumbling, I've got to wait, I've got to wait, I've got to wait. And I'm like, wait for what? You know, this. I know you don't want to, but this is the moment, you know. Just release, let go, relax, and it'll all be over. And early in the morning, somebody comes rushing in and says, am I too late? And they're like, what do you mean? I'm looking for this woman. It was her long-lost daughter, her estranged daughter, who somehow had heard that her mother's dying and came racing to be there. And the mother somehow instinctively knew she couldn't die until this girl... Wow. This is getting me choked up here. And this woman shows up, and they have a final moment, and then she dies. She let go immediately. It's like, wow. I mean, that's what this is about.
So powerful. And, you know... That's not an isolated event.
No, it's not.
We deal with that, yeah. many times. And again, that gift of time that we have with one another. And you know, I think on one level, we all, you know, if you were to call it academically, we all know we're going to die.
Right.
It's not that we want dad to live forever and to be 952 years old, but we want him to, when he goes, that he knows that he's loved,
mm-hmm.
that he has the chance to forgive those people who, you know, mm-hmm. for whatever reason, there's, you know, been hurt. And also to know that he is not going to go out gasping for air. He's not going to be in pain.
Yes.
And so when I heard you say that, Paul, you know, some things came into my mind. Like as a medical profession, we've got a long way to go. We've made progress in really not seeing it as failure. I mean, we can't
right.
always try to make someone live forever and just do things to them for the sake of doing them. But really taking a step and listening and saying, is this what she would want?
Yes.
Is this in her heart of hearts? Is this what she's communicated? And then, like you said, once she's put those things in order, you know, she can comfortably go.
Yeah. I mean, and when I said academic, my point was this. We talked about it a little bit before, too, before the show, is we are a society that is, I mean, just go into any Barnes & Noble. Okay? We are a society that's just driven by growth and self-actualization.
Oh, yeah. Personal
and
growth.
Especially with
how
boomers.
How to fix your marriage, lose weight, how to start a career.
Right, how to prepare for pregnancy. How many books are out there on that, right? How many books are out there? I mean, the way I got involved with senior industry was a gentleman by the name of Ryan Malone. I'm giving a plug to Ryan Malone. He's in Orange County.
Good Irishman.
Right. Ryan Malone was a youngish kid. He was the youngest, I think, or his mom had him late in life. And he all of a sudden found himself faced with having to deal with his mother getting older and assisted living specifically. And he looked around. His background is internet. He looked around, and nothing that he could find was written from the perspective of those shared experiences of a person going through it from the perspective of a how-to to the family. It was all very academic. It was all very university-level.
Cold is the word. Cold.
I'm not comfortable with the word cold, because a lot of people that have been accused of maybe being cold are people maybe that just provide that kind of service so often that there's a certain matter-of-factness to it, how they go about it. You know, and so he ended up basically putting up a blog to work through his stuff as he was dealing with his mother, which then became a resource, and it's up there as a website called Inside Elder Care. And he's a tech guy by you know, his bread and butter is he's a tech guy, owns his own company, but this is the kind of thing. This is something that happened 6-7 years ago, and to me was novel to be out there when it came to assisted living and seniors, right? I don't know of anything that is a resource of that nature.
Assisted dying.
For just informing, like sharing stories, a place for somebody to say, this was my experience, and this is the emotional stuff where I can, with safety, share that.
Well, hopefully that's what this show is. Give us some stories. You had some other ones here, you guys.
I just want to say, Rad, those things take time. I mean, to share it at that level, and especially within families.
Sure.
I mean, people you've known all your life, and yet it takes time and at the right place. And especially as we look at dying, I mean, setting that place with a team of a social worker to really help families coalesce with the medical expertise and the clinical training of the medical and nursing staff, it really puts people at ease to know that their symptoms and their disease process will be taken care of, so that they can have those conversations. They can have those
And the counseling, the religious aspects of it to face what's coming here.
Yes, and have those intra-family blogs, as it were.
Right. Yeah.
So give us some stories. You were saying
give us some stories.
One of my patients just this week, he'd shared with me that he would rather be dead than deal with the pain that he was experiencing. And so my team sat down together with him, myself, the social worker, and nurse, and really helped explore that. Well, definitely his wife, I mean, was badgering him. And his son was, like, just, you know, pulling his hair out, helpless also. And
badgering him to do what? Fight on or something here? Or?
Fight on, but also he was getting pretty grumpy.
Oh.
Right? And it was just really wearing on the entire family.
The dynamic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, definitely, if he's telling me that you know death is preferable to this pain, I take that seriously. And so again, we have, you know, pain management expertise in treating that, and quite quickly by putting him on our higher level of care, daily visits, and really real time adjustments of his medications. By the next 2 days, he was up in his front wheel walker and singing. And at that point, he was like, you know, dying, I still got some time to live.
Yeah,
and
right.
I think that gave him that gift
really
back.
It,
and
right.
It actually gave his wife, she the social worker checked in again. She said, you know, she's still pretty grouchy. But, I mean, again, it gives that space for people to work through it, because they feel that they're being taken care of. It's not just, right. I mean, it'd be one thing to just pat people on the back and then pretend that things are going to be okay. But this, we are not the old idea of hospice, where we're just washing our hands and just saying, oh, you're going to die. Here's some morphine. Have at it. No, quite the opposite. We're in it for the long haul. Mm-hmm. So to give room and space for these, for expert clinical management and these stories to play out.
Do people want to be sedated and out of it when they die, or do they want to be, do you want to
aware.
Feel it aware?
It's always a balance. I mean, certainly the clinical pain needs to be addressed, but we never hasten the death process by any of our pain interventions. We always want the patient to have, and their families to have the benefit of clarity and alertness. Mm-hmm. And so it's always a balance. And so that's our approach. Sherry, do you want to share any of the stories that you've experienced?
Yeah, sure. I just want to express the need to talk about this with your family, to put in place advanced directives, because over the years when I've met with families in the hospital, sometimes they've had their mom has had a stroke and is unable to make any decisions for herself, and there's large families. I'm recalling one over at Western Med Santa Ana where there were 10 children. Five children said, "We want everything done. We want mom to be kept on a ventilator and feeding, you know, artificial nutrition indefinitely." And five of the family members said, "No, no, mom would hate this. She would never, you know, want to have live like this." And because there wasn't really someone dedicated or designated to make decisions, this family was in such turmoil. And
all of which could have been solved if mom, when she was alive, said, "This is my advance directive. This is what I want
done. This is what I want." Mm-hmm. And Dr. Bui and I, we were talking to Rod a little bit earlier that sometimes we'll do community education about advance directives. And always there's one or two people that will kind of sidle up to us after the class or before and say, "You know, my family forbid me to come to this. They don't want me talking about this. You know, this is a taboo topic that they're afraid if we talk about it that something bad will happen." But just working in this field for so long, you really have to have these conversations.
All right, so I'll give you my quick example here again. My father's dying. Suddenly, you know, falls, hits his head, has a bleeding in the brain. I go rushing out to Palm Springs, and they walk in and they say, "Okay, he's probably going to die. But we could do this, and maybe we do this," and all this kind of stuff. And they say, "Has he got an advance directive?" "No." "What do you mean, no?" "So I have to immediately say, all right, do you want us to resuscitate him if he has a heart attack?" "Well, I guess." "Do you want him to do this? Do you want to stick a feeding tube in? Do you want to?" I'm like, and very, very specific kinds of things here.
That must have been very scary to make those decisions
right there,
under the gun.
Under the gun. Yeah. I'm trying to make all these decisions here. And so I couldn't make any decisions, so I said, "I don't know what to do. And I'm just going to punt. You know, you take this, God. I'm too chicken. I can't say any of this stuff."
Well,
here,
we've talked about this on other shows. You know that, you know, parents, don't put us in those situations.
Don't put me through this. Yeah.
But I want to just step back for a minute for people who are not clear on, and maybe I'll defer to the doctor. Could you give us just a quick snippet on what is advanced directives?
Advanced directive is not very complex. It's really just saying ahead of time what I want done and what I would prefer not happen to me.
Right.
As a medical professional, the default would be do everything.
Right.
Because
right,
just like you said, it gives time to kick the can down the road and, you know, figure it out later.
Right.
And sometimes that's appropriate in the acute setting. So, you know, a person is drowning. You rescue them.
Yes.
And then you figure it out. And then maybe you would pursue with family. Did he or she actually indicate before time that they would want CPR done or not done? And then,
do they want to be kept on a ventilator? Do they want to be fed, force-fed? Do they want to have all this kind of stuff done to them?
Right. It's an actual document that basically people fill out and basically notarize.
We should get one and attach it. There are ones you can buy at LegalZoom and other places or forums, or the most hospitals have one.
I'll get one and we'll put it up on the Facebook page.
So here's the end of the story. So I did nothing. My dad rallies and recovers. Hallelujah. I didn't kill him here. Okay? And so he comes back, and over the next few months, he's up. He's going to make it. He's down. He's going to die. Up, down, up, down. Finally, I took him off. I had him on the advance directive. It said, do nothing. Let him die. Don't do all these things. He'd much rather just go. I know that. And then when you get better, I take him off. Don't, you know, do everything you can. He's getting better here. So at one of those moments, I took him off the advance directive, and the next day he had a heart attack. And so they called me up and they said, the bad news is your dad just had a heart attack. The good news is we saved him. Now, of course, he's in a coma. He's a vegetable right now here. And I'm like, that's exactly what he told me 1,000 times he didn't want to have happen.
Yeah.
I just did exactly what he didn't want to do. So for 2 weeks, he's a complete vegetable, completely brain dead. And I have to go do the one thing I never wanted to do. And that he's swore to me, don't ever do this, I had to pull the plug.
And so, Paul...
I screwed it up at the last minute here, Dad. Sorry. You know, trying to
You had to fill in advance directives under duress, basically.
Mm-hmm. And I take it on,
and
I
you
put
had
it off,
to basically then deal with that depending on changing conditions. And with all that, never allowed the time to actually just come to terms with it.
No. So as he got better, I thought, okay, good, then now he's going to rally, so do everything you can to support him. Then he'd get worse, and I'd put him back on it. No, he's going to die, so let him just go. And we went on and on and on like this, and at the last minute, I made apparently the wrong decision.
And when I'm hearing you say this, what an emotional roller coaster that is. And again,
nobody should go through what I went through.
Yes, and then, you know, and at this point, you're looking back, the words that come to mind are still, I did the worst thing possible. Mm-hmm. And it's hard enough to lose Dad.
Yes.
But to have that lack of clarity ahead of time really is a burden.
Paul, when did your father pass away?
Hmm. He passed away 2 years ago now.
See, and I'm people
still chokes me up.
Yeah, I was going to say, people can't see you. I'm sitting across the studio here from you, and I can tell that this is something that's very fresh.
Well, because my dad was a big, powerful guy, and I always wanted to please him. Every son wants to please their father and everything, so I wanted to hear him. You know, you only get one shot to do this right. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to make up for the funeral. I did an elaborate funeral just like he wanted, and we had a big party, and he wanted to make sure he had the good booze out so all his friends knew he wasn't going cheap. That was a big thing to him. And so, like, okay, we had the prime stuff with the labels turned out just like you wanted, Dad. But I screwed up.
Sounds
that
like he's
other
proud of you with that.
You know, I tried to do the best I could, and in one key way, I made a mistake.
See, and doing the best we can is what all our intentions are. Having this lady and gentleman in the studio basically is, again, reemphasizing we can do the best we can, but we don't have to go it alone.
And I was completely alone. There was nobody. I'm an only child, so there was nobody else to do it. The good news is I didn't have to fight with anybody about it. The bad news is I had nobody to turn to. And you can turn to your wife or your friends or something, but it's your parent right there, and you want to get it right for them and for you.
Sherry, let me ask you something. Going back to Vitas, what services do you guys provide? I mean, to patients. I mean, there's a range, I think, right?
Got a couple minutes left.
Yeah. Right. Well, there's levels of care. So we talked about the team members who follow patients wherever they call home. But if they need an intense level of care inpatient, it means that they're in a skilled nursing facility and they have symptoms out of control. In that case, we really have more concentrated visits by a physician every day, by the nurse case manager. It's kind of like all hands on deck to make sure the person is as comfortable as possible, as quickly as possible. If a patient is at home or in a board and care facility, assisted living, where they don't have the medical staff right there, like a facility, we have something called intensive comfort care, where we can provide shifts of care, 8-hour shifts, for patients who have symptoms out of control. So it's nice to know that if they're in crisis, help is on the way. Routine care is what we provide for everyone whose symptoms are managed. That's on average, Vitas will visit a patient 5.5 times a week by a variety of people, home health aides to help them bathe, nurses to make sure the medications are effective, social workers. You know, Paul, when you tell your story, a social worker in this case would have really helped you to understand what options were available and that it's okay and you shouldn't feel guilty that you're acting out of a place of love. And
yes.
You know,
and it would have been nice. It was nice he was at least in the hospital or somebody to bathe him and do things.
Sure.
Picture taking your dad at his final days and you're going to wipe his butt and do these other things. I mean, I had to do some of that, and it was that was something I wasn't ready for. Well, my big, tough dad, I'm wiping his rear end here. Yeah.
Like Dr. Bowie was saying, you know, it allows you, that somebody being there for hospice care allows you to be the son.
Yeah, right.
And some people find...
Suddenly I was the doctor, and I was the caregiver, and I'm the counselor, and I'm trying to make decisions I wasn't ready to make, and nobody... Right. And they don't tell you. They just say, here's the options. Go figure it out. We'll be back in 5 minutes. Tell me what you want to do.
Sure. And some people find that once we empower them, that they actually have the tools they need. They just didn't know they had them. That this is a very loving way to connect to their parent or whoever is on hospice, that... by providing this care, by, you know, helping to bathe them or whatever they can do, that it really helps them in their own journey.
There is nothing more powerful than to make sure that your parent, at the final moment, mm-hmm. everything is said, everything is done to make them comfortable, everything is done to make this go the way they want it to, and to so that at the end there's no regrets, there's no yes. worries, and to face it and go through it and deal with it and not sit there and forever, like I sort of do, sounds like, you know, question what you did here.
Well, I think that questioning will be with you for a long time.
Yeah, maybe forever.
Sherry, let me ask you. You touched on it a little earlier, but I think it's important to remind people, how is the service paid for?
Right. I know we mentioned that it's a Medicare benefit, but really, Medi-Cal, most private insurances cover hospice at 100%. So, amazingly, there's no deductible, no co-payments. You know, we provide that entire team, including the doctor's visits, equipment, supplies. It's all paid for by your insurance. So certainly I would encourage people to ask their doctor about hospice. Physicians are still uncomfortable about this topic in conversation, so they don't bring it up timely.
Well, it's a tough topic. I mean,
right.
Yeah.
But if a family member says, gosh, I want to know more about hospice, mm-hmm. you know, the physician says, oh, great, I have a green light to broach this topic, and sometimes it makes it easier coming from that perspective.
Well, let me. We're
out of time, so yeah. I think we're down to the last.
Yeah. So
60
let me just say, if any of our audience actually had a relative facing potential terminal health situation, how do they get hold of you?
Sure, they can call us directly at 714-921-2273. Or go on vitas.com. That's VITAS.com.
And don't wait till that moment to have this conversation. Do it now when you can still think and you're not clogged with emotions here.
Give yourself a chance to actually get ready.
Right.
Thank you so much, Sherry.
So much.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Bui, I appreciate it being here. And thanks, everybody, for listening in. Thanks, Paul. See you next week.
You have been listening to the Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gontos, brought to you on the one and only OCTalkRadio.net. Join us again next week as we continue our journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older.